broken. She writes, my daughter LW came out as transgender late in 2020. She was just shy of 13. 4.5 years later, she's thriving, healthy, and happy after pursuing evidence-based gender-affirming care. I've devoted myself to finding our daughter consistent care in one state after another. The nightmare of our disrupted life pales in comparison with the nightmare of losing access to the health care that's allowed our daughter to thrive. If one thing gives me hope, it's my daughter. Even after all the emotions of today, LW has been texting me all day about her plans for how to continue the fight for young people like her. Tell us more, Chase.
Yeah, so I mean, I think Samantha hits it on the head. Is these are parents who watched their children suffer tremendously for many years, looking for a solution, doing their own research, talking to medical experts. And then what they found was that their children who were experiencing this intense distress began to thrive when they had access to gender-affirming medical care like hormones and puberty blockers. And these are not rushed decisions. These are careful decisions that parents are making with their children and their doctors. And what Tennessee did, what these other governments have done, is come in and displace the judgment of parents and adolescents and doctors and substituted their own ideological preferences for how people live and identify.
Clearly a blow to the transgender community. It was a 6-3 ruling. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the majority, opening, quote, saying, this case carries with it the weight of fierce scientific and policy debates about the safety, efficacy, and propriety of medical treatments in an evolving field. The voices in these debates raise sincere concerns. The implications for all are profound. The Equal Protection Clause does not resolve these disagreements. And again, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said the high court, quote, abandons transgender children and their families to political whims, as well as undermines the Constitution, saying the decision causes, quote, irrevocable damage to the Equal Protection Clause and invites legislatures to engage in discrimination by hiding blatant sex classifications in plain sight. In sadness, I dissent, Justice Sotomayor said.
Yeah, I mean, I think Chief Justice Roberts' language there is just wrong in so many different ways. First, the medical debate that he is referencing was not a debate that the district court found in the court's factual findings. It was a Trump-appointed district court judge who looked at the evidence and concluded that the Tennessee's arguments in support of their ban just did not bear did not hold up to scrutiny. But even more importantly, the question of whether or not the law discriminates based on sex on its face does not consider that medical debate. Looking at the plain language of the statute, it says you can do something consistent with your sex, you can't do something inconsistent with your sex. If the court starts importing their own ideas about what's a good or bad sex-based distinction, we're back to 50 years ago when they're allowing all sorts of discriminatory laws to stand.
What's Bostock and explain how it's affected by this?
Yeah, so as much as this is a devastating decision, I think it's important to make sure people understand that it does not do some of the damage that people feared. So Bostock is a 2020 Supreme Court decision in which the court held that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits sex discrimination in employment, also prohibits discrimination against LGBTQ people. And that decision was a 6-3 decision from Justice Gorsuch. And in the Scrimeti case, the court explicitly leaves intact that decision. And the court says that they are declining to address whether that decision applies outside the context of Title VII. And that's important because it means that litigation over things like discrimination in school, other forms of discrimination by the government, remain open to fight another day.
Can you talk about the other cases in the last few weeks that have gone actually both ways? But before you do, I mean, the irony of conservative justices and conservative states or states run by Republicans that have always insisted, for example, when it comes to abortion, a kid has to tell their parents when it comes to parental consent, etc. You have LW's parents with a doctor in a room with LW, they're all hashing this out.
Yes, you have this aligned judgment of parents adolescents and doctors, and the government is coming in and imposing their preference. The same governments that in every other context are spouting how important parental rights are. Parental right to not mask your child. Parental rights to not have your child learn about LGBT people in school or the history of racism in the United States. So this is hypocrisy at its most clear point. And I think we should really be watching for when the Supreme Court upholds the parental rights of parents to, for example, stop their children from accessing contraception or abortion. But when it's the parents who love and support their trans children, all of a sudden their parental rights don't matter.
Separately, on Wednesday, Trump's health department ordered the National Suicide Hotline for LGBTQ plus youth to shut down. In its announcement, HHS omitted reference to the transgender population, using the term LGB plus youth services. One advocate called the move a potential death sentence for thousands of LGBTQ plus youth. It reminded me of erasing from the federal website around Stonewall, which is a federal monument now, that was led by trans women that launched the modern day LGBTQ movement, taking out the T there. What about here? And what about the hotline itself, what it means?
Yeah, I mean, this is a population that has a unique vulnerability to suicidality. This service was vital for LGBTQ young people. And what the administration is doing is making abundantly clear that their systematic attacks on the LGBTQ community are not about protecting anyone. They are about harming young people, taking away vital services. If you put this in conversation with the bans on trans people serving in the military, the bans on people going to the bathroom, participating in sports, and now the decision in Scrimeti, you have a country that is prepared to not only fully attack us across all areas of life, but take away our lifelines, quite literally.
Can you talk about Judge Young and the decision that came out of Boston?
Yeah, so this is a decision in a challenge to the government's attempts to cut off NIH grants anytime they reference LGBT people or people of color. And Judge Young issued an injunction, in essence, forcing the government to reissue those grants, and said from the bench that in his 40 years on the bench, he has not seen such rank discrimination on the basis of race, and that this is plain as plain can be, that this government is invested in discriminating against people of color and LGBT people, and ordered them to restart those vital grants. Because not only are we living in a moment that is anti-people of color, anti-LGBT people from this administration, but they are also anti-science and cutting off vital research avenues that judges thankfully are stepping in and trying to restore as much as possible.
And Young was a Reagan-appointed judge. He said he's never seen discrimination like this.
Yes, and there's another Reagan-appointed judge in the District of D.C. that ordered the administration to stop banning gender-affirming medical care for trans people in the Bureau of Prisons. This is an administration that is attacking us in every aspect of life, and judge after judge across the political spectrum, going back to Reagan-appointed judges, are stepping in and saying absolutely not.
Can you respond to the New York Times piece that just came out, major hit piece against you, Chase, that was written by Nicholas Confessori? Its headline, How the Transgender Rights Movement Bet on the Supreme Court and Lost. Confessori writes, quote, Strangio and other advocates for trans rights have cast Scrimeti as the case they had to bring, and may also have set back their movement back a generation.
Well, I think that's just absolutely wrong. This is a fight that extends back 100 years, and we will keep fighting for 100 more years. The piece absolutely gets it wrong in terms of what this decision does and doesn't do. It's a narrow decision. It leaves open many other avenues to fight back against discrimination on behalf of trans people. But for everyone who is saying that the movement got ahead of public opinion, that litigators got ahead of public opinion, the very purpose of the Equal Protection Clause, the very purpose of the Reconstruction Amendment, amendments is to be a check on majoritarian discrimination. If the public's opinion is that you deserve to have your constitutional right infringed, then the very purpose of the Constitution is to step in. That is the role of the federal courts, and that is the role of civil rights advocates, and we will keep fighting.
The hit piece comes at the same time as a major documentary on you, Chase. The documentary premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. It was also at D.C. Docs, the new film festival in Washington, D.C. It's called Heightened Scrutiny. It shows you addressing trans community members and supporters outside the Supreme Court after you made history as the first openly trans lawyer to deliver oral arguments in front of the court. The hearing back in December was for this case.
We are the defiance of everything. Okay. Peppermint loves to give me advice about how to project. That's all I'm going to work on. We are collectively a refutation of everything they say about us. And our fight for justice did not begin today. It will not end in June, whatever the court decides. We are in this together. We are in it together. Our power only grows. I love being trans. I love being with you. And we are going to take care of each other. Thank you for being here. I felt it inside.
That's Chase Strangio, a clip from the new film, Heightened Scrutiny, that will also premiere in Los Angeles next week at the Hammer Museum. Talk about what you're hoping to accomplish with this film.
Well, I think one of the really important things about this film is that it offers a critique of mainstream media coverage of transgender people and our healthcare, in addition to the verite parts that are me preparing for oral argument. And one of the things the film really highlights is the ways in which the media's outsized fixation on transgender people contributes to anti-trans policymaking. Media Matters reported that in the last 4 months, Fox News ran 400 segments on transgender athletes. If you think about the fact that we are less than 1% of the population, transgender athletes must be 1/100th of a percent of the population, and yet this outsized fixation with us and our lives is what is driving so much of the anti-trans policies that we're seeing. And so it's so important that we challenge those narratives, that we make people aware of the misinformation that they are receiving, because if we don't, we're going to continue to see these attacks.
And finally, the decision also this week around passports.
Yeah, I think it's really important for people to know that we're still getting good decisions in the lower courts. The judge said that, in essence, Trump's policy of forcing people to have passports listing their sex assigned at birth is blocked, not just for our six named plaintiffs, but for everyone across the country. People can reapply for both binary passports and X passports under the policy.
Explain what you mean. Either your male, female doesn't have to match your
sex assigned at birth. So if
You can do X.
Or you can do X. And that was the policy on January 19th. And in essence, the court says we're back to January 19th with respect to the policy. And transgender people, non-binary people, and intersex people can apply for the M, F, and X passports that match who they are, not what their sex was at conception, which is the Trump administration's preference.
Chase Strangio, thanks so much for being with us. Co-director of the American Civil Liberties Union LGBTQ and HIV Project. In December, he became the first openly trans lawyer to argue in front of the Supreme Court when he presented oral arguments in the United States v. Scrimeti. Coming up, we speak to a Columbia University graduate who was just denied entry back into the United States because of his writing about pro-Palestine protests on campus. The authorities at the airport were very explicit about why they were deporting him. Stay with us.
And you can only view you with what you got. You don't have to pretend that you gotta know more. 'Cause you are young, Latin, and proud. Young, Latin, and proud. Young, Latin, and proud. Young, Latin, and proud. 'Cause you woke up feeling like this. You woke up knowing that you'll be you for the rest of your life. For the rest of your life. 'Cause you are young, Latin and proud. Young, Latin and proud. Young, Latin and proud. Young, Latin and proud. And we are young, Latin and proud. Young, Latin and proud.
Young, Latin and proud by Lado Negro, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman. An Australian writer was recently detained for some 15 hours, then deported from a U.S. airport for his writings about pro-Palestine protests at Columbia University. Alistair Kitchen was detained by border agents after he'd flown from Melbourne, Australia, to Los Angeles. He reports a border agent told him, quote, look, we both know why you're here. When Kitchen said he didn't know why, the agent reportedly said, quote, it's because of what you wrote online about the protests at Columbia University. Alistair had graduated from a master's program at Columbia last year when the protests against Israel's war on Gaza began. He'd written about the student encampments on his Substack page. PEN America said Kitchen's detention and deportation was, quote, gravely concerning. Jonathan Friedman of PEN America said, quote, Kitchen's account fits a disturbing pattern in which border agents appear to be screening visitors to the U.S. for their viewpoints. That is anti-democratic, and it must be halted, unquote. We go now to Australia, where we're joined by Alistair Kitchen. The New Yorker magazine recently published his account of what happened in a piece headlined, How My Reporting on the Columbia protests led to my deportation. Alistair, thanks so much for staying up late to talk to us. Tell us the day this all happened, where you were, and just what took place.
Well, I had flown 15 hours all the way to LAX, and frankly, I was prepared for something to go wrong. There's been plenty of media here in Australia about tourists getting detained at U.S. airports for all range of reasons. I've written about the protests and I've written critically about the Trump administration. So I went ahead and scrubbed my phone, scrubbed my social media feed. But just as I got to get into the passport queue for my ESTA, my visa waiver, I was detained and interrogated and told that the reason was, as you say, what I had written online.
So explain what happened. You come off your plane and were people waiting for you there?
Yeah, this is crucial. They were waiting for me when I got off the plane. I didn't even make it into the queue for passport processing. Instead, the intercom went over the loudspeaker and my name was called. I was asked to meet an officer at the back of the room. And he immediately took me away, immediately asked for my phone, and then immediately asked for the passcode of that phone. I said I'd rather not hand over my passcode. He said, that's fine. We will immediately deny you entry and deport you. And that's when I made the wrong choice to hand over the passcode to my phone, believing wrongly and hoping wrongly that they would see that I'm a writer, that I was writing about the protests in the capacity as a journalist, and that I certainly pose no threat to the country, and that I have many loved ones in the U.S.
Well, describe the scene where you were brought to. Who else was there, both detainees like you, how long they'd been there? And then, I mean, the questioning took place over hours, is that right?
Yeah, right. I was first taken to this back room. I was sat down. The questioning began immediately with this opening gambit about Israel and Palestine. I was asked questions about what my thoughts were on the conflict, how I would solve it. Do I know any Jews? Do I know any Muslims? I was asked to hand over the names of student groups I was involved with, WhatsApp groups, with other protesters, all of which I refused to do. And then after some time, after he was satisfied, he then began the process of downloading the contents of my phone. He went away, disappeared for some time, came back out, And that was when I really knew I was in trouble, because he said to me, "Mr. Kitchen, we've found evidence on your phone of prior drug use. On your ESTA visa waiver form, you represented to us that you had not consumed drugs before. That misrepresentation is grounds for denial of entry and deportation." That was maybe 1 to 2 hours in of a 12-hour process. I was interviewed at that point. I was interviewed again maybe 6 hours later in a Groundhog Day moment where all of the same questions were asked. And in the meantime, I was held in a detention room with, there were 5 women in there. I was the only man when I arrived.
Can I just interrupt?
Yes,
on the issue of drugs? In New York State, you can consume marijuana. Can you explain what they were talking about?
Yeah, so I previously, they identified that I had consumed, and I admitted to having bought marijuana in New York State. This is very important for any international listeners of yours. If you buy marijuana in California, in New York, you are doing so legally by state law, but you're doing so illegally by federal law. And therefore, in the eyes of Customs and Border Protection, you are breaking the law and you're misrepresenting your behavior when you said that you haven't consumed illicit drugs.
So if you can respond to what the U.S. government is now saying to various media outlets, a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security said using the ESTA is a privilege and a right, and only those who respect our laws and follow the proper procedures will be welcomed. And they denied that DHS said that they denied that they were targeting you for your political beliefs. That seems to run counter to what you were told when you were being interrogated. And tell us how much into the conversation, into the interrogation you were questioned, and what the agent said to you about your political writing.
Yeah, it's contrary explicitly to what they told me as soon as I arrived. And to this extent, I'm lucky. I'm lucky that they were so forthcoming in the moment and so brazen as to say, look, we both know why you're here. It's because of what you've written online. I'm going to interrogate you now about what you've written online. Now, the DHS now wants to come out and deny that. Of course they do. And of course, they want to focus on the drug case as grounds for deportation. I'm not disputing that at all. Of course, what I'm here to say is that Customs and Border Protection are using the immense power and discretion that they have to search and then to deny entry under politically motivated grounds and politically motivated reasons. They're doing so clearly and explicitly in their own words, because they disagree with some people's speech, they didn't like what I said, so they went looking for a reason to deport me.
So your final takeaway from this detention and deportation, what you felt you would warn people about?
Yeah, the first is, this might sound severe, but if you don't have a great reason to go to the United States and you're a tourist, this might not be the time. The second is that if you have anything sensitive on your phone, do not take that phone. Take a burner phone, buy it early, populate it with some content so that it doesn't look suspicious. And the third thing is, if all that fails and you end up in the position that I was in, and you were offered, after getting off a 15-hour flight, a choice between deportation and having your phone searched and downloaded, my view is accept immediate deportation, spend the 12 hours in detention, and go home, because by the time they're ready to look through your phone, they're never going to let you in anyway.
Alistair Kitchen, I thank you for being with us. Australian writer deported last week, wrote about his experience for The New Yorker in a piece headlined, How My Reporting on the Columbia Protests Led to My Deportation. We will link to it at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're going to turn right now to ranked choice voting. As New Yorkers head to the polls in the primaries for upcoming local elections Tuesday, voters will have the chance to vote for not one, but up to five of their preferred candidates for mayor and other races. Early voting, actually, is taking place now through Sunday. This is a brief explainer from the New York Board of Elections.
There's a new way for New Yorkers to have their say in city elections. A way that gives voters more choices and can lead to more diverse winners. It's called ranked choice voting. 74% of New York voters chose to use it in primary and special elections for city offices, mayor, public advocate, comptroller, borough president, and city council.
This is a relatively new system for New Yorkers. It was introduced following a referendum in 2019. It's also in use in Maine and Alaska, is gaining interest across the country. Early voting underway now through the weekend ahead of Tuesday's primary. I spoke to John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent, closely following New York City's mayor election, began by asking him how ranked choice voting works and how it came to New York.
Sure. So ranked choice voting was first implemented in San Francisco in 2004, and it's now used in about 40 cities and towns across the United States, including in Oakland, Boulder, Colorado, Minneapolis, Burlington, Vermont, Tacoma Park, Maryland, and other places. And it's also used statewide in Maine and Alaska. And like that announcement was saying, we had a voter referendum in New York that approved it in 2019, and we first implemented it in 2021 in our last mayoral cycle here in New York.
And what's the problem it's correcting?
Well, the problem it's correcting in our kind of winner-take-all electoral system is that if you vote for a lower-performing candidate in a race where there's a lot of candidates, your vote can be wasted or spoiled. And an example I think many people could relate to in your audience is in Florida 2000, when Ralph Nader got 97,000 votes and Al Gore ultimately lost the presidency by 537 votes. If there had been ranked choice voting, Green Party supporters who might have wanted to keep, you know, the Republican from getting the White House, they could have made Al Gore their second choice.
They could still do Ralph Nader first,
yes,
but they would make Al Gore second.
Yeah, and it was, so all those debates about, you know, spoilers and wasted votes that we get every 4 years in presidential politics, if we had ranked choice voting, people could vote. It allows you to both vote for who you most want, but then to also make a second choice selection for other candidates that you also like. And it prevents the dynamic, if you vote for a low-performing candidate, that someone else that you would least want to win ends up prevailing. So it gives voters more choices and more power in determining the ultimate winner of an election.
And so when was it first instituted here in New York? The election is Tuesday.
Yeah, it was first instituted in our city elections in 2021. Under our rules here in New York, you can vote in order of preference for as many as five candidates. So you can, it's really changed the dynamic of the election here.
So, John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent. You can see the full interview online. Early voting goes through Sunday in the New York City primary for mayor. Primary day is Tuesday. That does it for our show. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology. You can find out more at democracynow.org/jobs. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Anjali Kamet, Safwat Nazal, Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Trolling college music so you don't have to. No loyalties, no orthodoxy. Keeping it real, dumb, and organic since 2019. Tune into Home of Burnaby Rock with John on Fridays from 6 to 8 p.m.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live to help victims and survivors get vital social and emergency services. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call 1-833-
You're listening-